Welcome, everyone, to these Goldster podcasts where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles to hear enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration. Please enjoy. To find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome to Goldster Inside Story, where I will be your host for the next hour. My name is Humphrey Hawksley, and we are going to discuss a topic that some might chase to the end of the rainbow and where others might glaze at its mention. That topic is money. How many of us, and I have to confess that I'm one, either blur when complex finances are talked about or find myself overwhelmed by a banker or a billionaire who knows, or I think he knows much, she knows, he knows much more than I do. Is managing money really that complicated? Is it deliberately made confusing by banks and investment companies so they have more control over us? I have a guest that is going to answer those questions, waiting patiently for me to introduce her. Or is money just one of those necessary but boring elements of life, something we have to learn to live with or live without if life turns on its head? My guest today, looking elegant across the water at the Atlantic in central Canada, is an expert on money and a vocal advocate of how we should make money our thing and learn about it as we do activities that we enjoy, like booking our holidays, attending our gardens, taking our pets out. Is it right that we rely on a spouse, a parent, a friend to manage money for us because, well, we just don't understand it? That blur of bank statements, interest rates, credit cards, and percentage points going this way and that that are flung at us like pepper spray. Fear not. All that is to be made compelling and clear because welcome, Kaylee Boisvert, to Goldster Inside Story.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I like that intro.
It's well, thank you for being here with us, bringing your expertise on this sort of thing. I'm going to start with a basic question to you. Why do so many people find money intimidating?
That's a good question. And I think it's going to be a little bit personal for everyone. And oftentimes I would say it's based on like an experience with money. And that can be from, you know, growing up in like a childhood memory you have or a more recent one in your adult years. But you're right. Like a lot of us do. And I think that's really like the reason I wrote this book, because I learned at a very early age that money could be, and we can talk about this further in a bit, but just that, you know, you can have an element of control and you can empower yourself with money. But I was seeing like time and again that people were sort of like doing the things you were saying in the intro, kind of like hiding, turning away from it, you know, it feeling like it's too complicated and saying the things like, you know, I'm not good with math. I'm not good with numbers. Money just isn't my thing. And that was my inspiration for the title of the book, Make Money Your Thing, because I do think it can be easy and simple, but it has been sort of like given kind of this is very intimidating element to it. And I don't know where it comes from. I wish I did, but I think we need to kind of dive deeper into that for each individual unique person, see where it's coming from and sort of work on that, because we can all make money our thing. That's, again, the premise and the reason for the book is any stage of life, wherever you're at, you know, whatever your history is, wherever you're at on your journey, it can be your thing. You can feel comfortable. It doesn't have to be intimidating. It doesn't have to be scary at all.
And you're not saying this because, you're not I'll ask you outright. Are you a multi-billionaire, Kaylee?
No.
You're
I
not.
Wish.
So
one day.
So money is your thing because you feel that your life is more secure because you know how to manage it.
Exactly. Like making money your thing could be as simple as, you know, taking action on being aware of how much you're spending. So many people, I would say like so many people are guilty of the phrase, you know, I have no idea where all my money goes. We hear a lot of people saying that. And so just by taking some time and maybe looking at a past month, going through your expenses, categorizing them, seeing, okay, how much do I spend on my house expenses, food expenses, utilities, car, things like that, and sort of getting yourself that visual or that understanding. Well, there you go. You've made money your thing. You've taken something that you weren't aware of. Maybe you were sort of head in the sand approach, not wanting to know or take the time to do it, and you're doing it. And it's just that. So it doesn't have to be hard. Like, I think you're right when you said in the intro, you know, is it maybe that we overcomplicate it or the industry does? I think it does, which is unfortunate. And I do think we need to continue to find ways to break it down and simplify it. Because
is it that for most of us who are not heirs to fortunes, and that money was important to our parents and us, that when we were very young and first started our bank accounts, we didn't have much money, and the bank manager was onto us if we got overdrawn. And that letter from the bank manager or note saying you're overdrawn sticks with us as a sort of trauma experience.
Absolutely. You're right. Like, in using that word trauma, like, there is an element of money trauma we have when we go through an event that intimidates us or it makes us feel uncomfortable. It does create some trauma around the topic. I remember exactly that when I was a young person with my bank account. They had a $20 limit on my account for the longest time. So when I would go to take out money, and I was an adult by that time, like, I understand maybe my teenage years, but I'm an adult with my $20 limit in a time where we were using mostly cash. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And I would go in and complain to them, and they'd be like, oh, we fixed it, and they didn't. And I don't know, they almost, like you're saying, they kind of push you off and don't take you seriously. I would say still to this day, there's moments where I walk into a bank as a financial professional. I have an MBA in finance. I've worked in the industry for over 15 years. I've written a money book, but I walk into the bank sometimes and there is this element of feeling uncomfortable and almost feeling like you're being talked down to. And so, I mean, that's got to change, but I guess we have to do kind of some of the inner work to know that, okay, you know, it's okay. And going back to that money trauma and say, like, I'm not that teenager with no money and I deserve to be respected. Anyone does at any stage in life.
But I think it certainly sticks with me. Most of us, I would think that most of the population went through years of sort of sleeping on friends' floors or traveling around the world with no money or whatever it is. I just want to say to our wonderful audience out there, if you have got any stories about your money trauma, money successes, any billionaires amongst us, any impoverished people amongst us, let us know. Let us seriously know how handling money has impacted your life, and Kaylee will pick it up and talk about it, because I think this is a really interesting topic. I want to go back to your childhood or whatever. You are a qualified financial advisor now, but when you were a little girl, did you want to be an astronaut or a rock star, or did you always think you wanted to be what you are today?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, my mom asked when I was 4 years old, she said, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, I want to collect money.
You said
that's
that?
That's not a child. Yeah.
Why?
Not sure why. obviously, at the beginnings, I've always been fascinated with numbers. I have a numbers thing. But so growing up, we were actually very poor. We didn't have a lot of money. And, I tell my daughter, I was talking to her the other day because she left her room and she didn't turn the light on off after herself. And I was like, growing up in my household, Ivy, I'm like, it was a crime to leave lights on when you left a room. Like, you did not leave lights on. And I'm like, at nighttime, my mom would turn down the heat to like nothing and we would like freeze. And she would be like, we don't need it at night, you know, cover up warm, like all these ways to save money. And it was hard. And I feel like I need to share that with her because, you know, she has the luxury now of not having necessarily those same like restrictions. But that was my experience growing up. And I write about it too in the book. I share a story about it, particularly like a story when I was, I think, about 6 years old, and Christmas time, which kind of timely and relevant. And I had asked for a Barbie dream house. That was the only thing I wanted. And I figured I'd have to ask Santa because I knew my mom didn't have a lot of money. And I was, you know, on my best behavior, and I was like wishing for that dream house so badly. And then Christmas came, I opened my presents and there was no Barbie dream house. I got things like shoes and like very practical gifts. And again, because we didn't have a lot of money. And the next day I saw my friend, because we lived next door, and she came running up to me and she's like, guess what I got for Christmas? I got the Barbie dream house. And it was like my heart just like sunk at that moment. And I think it's just a really good kind of like story, like that experience of what it's like to grow up like that. And this idea of wealth and growing up in poverty. And at that time, what I started to internalize about myself is like, we don't have enough, we don't have as much. It was almost like a worthiness factor too. And I think that comes into play with these like money trauma, like we talked about, and things like that. So growing up, you know, poor, I also learned a lot and I was fascinated by numbers and money, but we can't like sort of, you know, throw out or like disregard that experience and how it kind of sticks with us. So that was my experience growing up. We didn't have a lot of money, but my mom sort of, I could see the stress. I had a single mom and I could see the stress that that money, that lack of money caused her. And I think from a very early age, that made me want to learn more. I wanted to figure it out. Like, I think when you see someone going through something and struggling, it's like you want to fix it. So even as a kid, I wanted to fix it. And so I became like this student of all things money and numbers. And I felt like I was, again, starting to kind of get a glimpse of like math and things like that. And again, numbers fascinated me. So I was like, if it's like a math problem, I can just figure it out. And so that was sort of my intro to it. And I just kept going with it and learning everything I could because I wanted to help my mom. Or, and then as I grew up, it was like, I want to help other people. As what I was learning, I want to share it. And so, yeah, I landed in this industry. And I think, you know, very much not by accident, like 4-year-old me knew that this was coming. I was going to collect money. But more importantly, it was, you know, that experience of not having enough, not having much, gave me so much more of a glimpse into understanding more than I think just the money. And so wanting to share this knowledge and what I'm learning about money, but also understanding, you know, meeting people where they're at and knowing how much, you know, stress and struggle that money can cause people and how it can be very traumatic and hard to work through.
So your motive is not to make people very wealthy, but to stop them being poor or to give them a security, like a sort of equivalent to a dry roof over their head when it comes to their finances.
Absolutely. Like you see it so well there, that security. I was saying that to my mom the other day because I was telling her about how I was telling Ivy that we were so broke. It's like a circle. We all just tell each other everything. And my mom's like, you know, we still had everything. And I'm like, you know, she did a good job. She was very resourceful and she worked so hard. But I said, but mom, don't you feel the difference now? Like how secure you feel? Because then eventually she got a job, started building up a pension. She's retired now. You know, her house is paid off. Like, I'm like, can't you see the difference between how, like, there's a safety element, how you feel now versus then? Before it was like, you know, you don't want anything to go wrong with your car because you can't afford to fix it. And then how are you going to get to work? And like, it spirals. And there is this security element that, yes, I want everyone to at least achieve that. I want everyone to at least know that you can be doing some steps in the right direction wherever you're at. You know, when she was a single mom raising us and we were really young, that was almost like a really hard season. Like we didn't have money and she didn't have any to spare to save and things like that. So I want people to acknowledge the reality is there's going to be probably seasons in your life that are really hard and you might not be able to, you know, be a real estate mogul and be buying properties and things like that. That some of these money books recommend that just feel a little bit overwhelming and out of touch. But you know, what are the things you can be doing? Because there's little things you can be doing and they're going to serve you very well for when you get through that really tough time and the other side of it, and it can look really good. So I want to meet everyone where they're at and acknowledge that we're all on this journey. We're all in a different place.
We've got some questions coming in or comments coming in, which I'll do in order. Ewan Grant, nice question. What indicators do you use to assess whether someone is good or bad at managing money?
That's horrible. I don't think I've ever told someone they're bad.
But in your own mind, you must know whether this person is going to blow it all.
Right. It's so funny. And people can tell this with their kids too. They'll have like 2 children. They'll be like, oh, this one's fabulous with saving and whatnot. But this one, oh, they're going to be a disaster. I'm like, it's so funny how it's like also they grow up in the same household and it can be different. So I think there's elements to even our sort of like personality types and like genetics that come into play. I like I can't deny that. Like, okay, in the simplest form, being good with money is thinking you're spending less than you earn because, you know, if money coming out is bigger than money coming in, you have a math problem there, right? So in its simplest sense, to be good with money, you're spending less than you earn. So you're saving money and you're investing money. You're getting your money to work for you. You're getting it to grow, compound, and that's going to lead to success. So those are the steps you need to take. It's very simple to break it down. So people are doing that and they're, I would say, good with money, spending less than you earn and saving and investing. And the people that would be quote unquote bad with money are just doing things like ignoring it, not taking time because and spending, you know, more than they're earned. It's that constant like struggle and no, like, I mean, I'm not trying to put anything out like against those people doing that. But I think it's an element that you have to kind of dig deeper in.
And when you bump into people, I think as we all do, that they've always got the next best project that's going to make them a millionaire. They just bought a racehorse or they just found a mining company in Greenland or something like that that's going to do that. Do you, in your industry, do you have a name for that sort of thing?
There probably is. Like, it's like a money type, right? Yeah. And it's sort of like chasing wealth and chasing the next big thing.
Yeah.
I would say always just like pull it back and again, just say like, keep it simple. That's the best way because chasing those things, I've seen that too with people. They'll buy this stock that their friend recommends that's like going to go to the moon and it doesn't. And so more times than not, it doesn't. So I think it's have really realistic expectations and just do the slow and steady things because even like the financial gurus of the world, if they're getting like 8% yearly compounded, that grows to really big amounts. But to some people that just sounds like boring or they're like, they want this quick route, like you're saying. And it's just, it's not easily achievable. It oftentimes doesn't work. So I would say always come back to that premise, like keep it simple, like keep that in your mind. How can I keep it simple?
That's it. So the people that are managing money well are the people that think of it in simple ways and keep it simple.
Yeah.
Surya? Yes, Surya has asked, managing money online is a nightmare these days with security issues, keeping up with technology. Your thoughts on that, please? Yes, on the security bit particularly.
That's tough. I'm like of a generation where I'm a millennial, kind of. I'm like on the upper cusp. So I like technology. And yes, there's moments where, you know, we have to be mindful of, you know, keeping our like passwords safe, things like that. But I trust technology and I trust kind of the backing of it. If something were to go wrong, you know, what are the checks and balances in place, making sure of that. So just making sure that the institution you're with, if you have those concerns, checking, you know, is there some element of insurance if something were to happen or what would occur if that occurred? And I think that kind of leads to, I would say the bigger concern to me would be more like a type of investor fraud or people kind of promising these products with really great returns and people going into things like that, which aren't backed by these agencies and insurance. So you don't really have any ability to, you know, put a claim against them if something were to happen. They can just, you know, go bankrupt, disappear, and there goes your money. So I would say, again,
this is the chasing the fortune thing we were talking about. So
exactly.
If you're with a big bank that's stayed with them and with their products, you're going to be safer, aren't you? Fiona Montgomery asks, is there an easy app or simple, brackets, hopefully method you recommend for tracking your finances regularly?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I tend to be, in this sense, more old school with how I track. There are all sorts of apps out there, but I find everyone has an opinion and it's what's going to work for you. Sometimes how they go about it is almost like hard to get your head around, wrap your head around. And the minute you're doing something that's confusing and difficult, you're probably just going to stop and not do it anymore. So my recommendation is always do what works for you, because if it's one of the, again, if it's a complicated, I can't figure this out, or I'm not quite sure how this is even working kind of scenario, you're not going to do it. It's going to fall off eventually and it's not going to be something you keep up with. So I would say do what works for you. It can be as simple for me. I do like an Excel spreadsheet. That's where I'm comfortable. So just I can enter the transactions in, or you can just get it pulled from your account into an Excel format. A lot of the banks will do that as well. And then just sort of organize it from there. Or again, simply as like having my online banking open and an Excel spreadsheet and putting in all the entries.
And actually physically change. There's not a sort of super app that you can put in that takes all your finances and sorts it out for you so you can look at it.
There's some, but I think the problem is it's like, then you have your bank, you have your credit card, you have, some people have a side hustle and they have, so it's just like humans, we get a little bit more complicated than some of those really work for. Yeah. So I would say, and I would say it's an exercise that like you can do maybe like once a year. I do it twice a year. I just take a look at a past month and I go through all the transactions, I categorize them and I see what am I spending on a monthly basis. And it's such a good activity because usually what I find is, oh, there's this subscription I signed up for that I don't use anymore. I'm going to cancel that. Oh, my insurance costs went up on my car. I'm going to call to see if there's any sort of discounts if I bundle it, or maybe someone else is offering something better and maybe it makes sense for me to change that. Or so it gets me thinking of creative ways to change things and actually do things about it. If you get the app doing all the work for you, oftentimes you're just going to be like, oh, there's the numbers. But when you're actually writing them down and seeing each number, you're digging in a little bit more, I think. And yeah, it's just an awareness exercise to say, I didn't realize I've been spending so much on takeout. I'm going to change that.
So your tip is, and actually I do it once a year, is to go through everything yourself and just remind yourself that you have got a subscription to the Times that you might not want anymore or to whatever.
Yeah.
And somebody has ripped. I've found on one of my credit cards last month, actually, that somebody had used it to open a Netflix account for themselves.
Yeah, so it's exactly like doing those things. You're going to spot that quicker. Yeah. You want to be mindful. But it's a new year, right? We're in a brand new year.
Yeah.
Why not take it? I mean, it's going to take you a couple hours, probably. I'm going to be honest, but go through last year and see, like, what if you could look at everything last year, put it in categories, and then you can decide, oh my, I'm spending, 20% on food and eating out. I'd rather spend, closer to 15%, get that down a little bit. And so now you can take control and make choices on what you want to change going forward. So I think like the new year is such a good opportunity for that. Take like an assessment of what you did, an inventory of what last year looked like.
Pauline Blaser got some very good advice here, which for me, two things are essential to manage money successfully when one is on a low income. Understand where and when your money comes from, which feeds it into understanding cash flow. Second, track it all. That's what we've been talking about. Every penny. I use a color-coded spreadsheet that I cross-reference to my bank account.
Love it. I have a story of that in the book, that there was a woman who came in and she had this budget. She was like folded out and there was all these colors. And I was just like so impressed. I'm like, exactly. Like budgets don't have to be, intimidating, boring. The ideas that come to mind usually when you say budget, people are like, well, but it can be fun. You can make it colorful. You can do those things. And again, it's very empowering. It's just an awareness exercise. It's not to beat yourself up and say, oh my gosh, I'm spending so much money and go into that shame spiral. No. It's a very like practical tool to say, oh, wow, I wasn't even aware I'm doing that. Because we're not. You're not aware. I would say most people are guilty of just doing it quickly in their head. Oh, I spend about this on my house, this, on this bill, that bill. And you do the quick math and you go, I know how much I spend about. And you're like, no, like, when you actually do the step-by-step, number-by-number in that spreadsheet, it's a wake-up call, but it's good.
I'm interested, but Pauline, let us know do you use sort of green for food and red for car and yellow for entertainment or something? Just give us an idea, because this sounds like a great tip. And as you say, it's a non-intimidating, non-boring way to look at how you spend your money. If you've gone through life and you've raised your kids and everything, and suddenly you find you're separated or you're bereaved and the other one was handling it all, what do you do?
That's a good question. And that's, I share a lot of stories in the book about that. Because a lot of the people I work with are women who have, you know, gone through divorce, lost their spouse, and now they're, you know, thrown into the driver's seat, whereas they weren't even a part of the conversation before. I've worked with women that say, like, you know, what do I do next? I've never even had my own bank account. So I'm like, so, I mean, I guess kind of that the proactive approach is just be involved, be engaged. If you're in a partnership, still be part of the conversation. In just some sense, I'm all about dividing and conquering. You know, if someone's better at it than the other person, by all means, like, do what's efficient, but still you always have to be engaged. And that's whether it's with a partner or whether you're working with a financial professional. You can't just turn a blind eye thinking, oh, you know, Kaylee's got it covered and she's going to deal with it all. I say that to my clients too. It's like, you need to be involved. You need to understand why I'm recommending what I'm recommending and, you know, what you're on track for and things like that. Because what if something were to happen to me, or, you know, what if something like that occurs? You always want to be engaged and not fully reliant on someone else. But if you have found yourself in a situation where you weren't part of it and now you're in that position, I would say, again, just take it really slow, be easy on yourself. Like, think of it as in that beginner's mindset that you're just starting out. Don't put a lot of pressure on yourself to think, you know, that's where the overwhelm comes from. Like, I can't understand this. It's way too complicated. Start small and baby steps. If it is a matter of just opening your own account, do that. Like, that's step one. Maybe it is reading a book about money. Maybe it's listening to a podcast. Little steps are going to compound, just like money does. They're going to compound and grow your financial knowledge and literacy. And I would, you know, again, urge people to, like, take it easy on yourself, because a lot of these concepts we don't learn about growing up. We don't learn this in school and education. It's usually not part of the curriculum. So if you feel really, like, lost and this is all new to you, by all means, I mean, it makes sense. Unfortunately, that's the reality, and it's not the way it should be, but that is the way it is. So I would say, be mindful of that. Take it slow. Be easy on yourself. And just, you know, one step at a time. Keep it simple. If something doesn't make sense and you are working with a professional or something like that, or you can ask someone, just keep asking the questions.
And if this suddenly happens to you, as you were talking, I was thinking, how much do I, but if this suddenly happens to you, you have got, for example, the house or the mortgage deeds, you've got whatever the car is, you've got all those bills that are on direct debit. You might have some capitals in investments you don't know about somewhere. And then you would have people all around you, some of them might be vultures, telling you what to do with it for their own interests.
Yes.
I got a correct scenario there?
You do. Yes. I have a chapter two, kind of blends into a few chapters I have, but the idea of staying in control, because no one's going to love your money as much as you. So you're right. The vulture, like, do they have your best interests at mind? Well, probably not. Like, there's probably, you know, they probably have a different agenda than you would, because you will always be the person who loves your money, who, you know, it's your money, like your hard-earned money. You will be the best person for that. So giving up control to someone else is never going to fully work. That's why you have to stay involved. Think of it as a partnership. You know, having that person help you, your accountability partner, your support, kind of pointing out things that you're not aware of. But don't ever think of it as like, okay, you take the lead and hand it all off. And it brings up the concept of one of my chapters called going on a money date, which is just about spending time with your money. So that idea you're saying of, like, taking that inventory, where is everything? You know, what does things look like? Spend time with your money. I would say the majority of us don't. You know, we spend more time planning our vacations and holidays than we spend just giving some time to our money. Yet our money is the tool that makes those things possible. So a money date is simply putting some time in your calendar and saying, okay, you know, on January 15th, I'm going to spend some time going through last year's expenses and getting some perspective on what I spent. I'm going to start doing tracking of my expenses and cash flow and things like that. Like, that's all money date is. It's devoting that time. So that's probably what's going to have to happen as well, is that you're going to want to devote some time to learning these things, to figuring it out, to taking that inventory.
And I think you've partly answered, but Suri asks, is it advisable to pass the control of money to grown-up children in old age? And perhaps if you could talk about the Is it called lasting power of attorney that we have over here, whereby if you become incapacitated, your affairs can be managed by somebody else?
Yeah, absolutely. Like in those cases, you want to have those in case of situations worked out. So absolutely, we want to go through some of those scenarios of what could happen. If you lost capacity, you're going to need someone to step in at that point for sure. And you probably can't stay engaged because at that point, you're deemed to not be able to make those decisions by like a medical professional. So at that point, of course, by all means, have something in place set up with someone you trust to be able to do that and give them really clear instructions on how you would want it dealt with. So there is no kind of doubts or questions in their mind. Because I'm sure when someone's sort of thrown into that position, they're kind of like, oh, well, you know, what would they want and things like that. So have a very clear kind of layout of exact scenarios of like, this is what I would want to happen. Go through kind of that each scenario of, you know, if this were to happen or if that were to happen, get those in place. Absolutely. But if it's just a matter of you're getting older and, you know, should you pass that down to your children? Again, I'd say not necessarily. If there's some things you want them to know of, get that in place for sure. But again, I think you're still the best person to be responsible, to be in control when you have the capabilities to do so. Again, just because you know you best and what you want. Yeah. It can create some drama and some, you know, family drama for sure. I've seen come out of that. So I would say you're still best to kind of be primarily one.
Have you been in situations where you've got in the book, actually, I think there's husband and wife, the financial advisor talks to the husband all the time. That's a decision. He says, ask her, the wife. But yeah. But have you been in a position where you have got a whole family with you and you can see the tensions and the pressures on that?
Yeah, it's kind of fun. You feel like you're like a fly on the wall and you know everything. So you can, absolutely. It's crazy. Like money does crazy things to people. I don't know like what the explanation is of it. It's unfortunate, but it does. Like in cases of divorce scenarios, the things that happen with money and the fighting over it and what kind of comes to play, it's shocking to everyone. Like, you know, women had said, like, they never expected their husband to be like this. Sorry. Treat them, you know, like to go after the money in that way. So it's, I don't know what to say. Like money does crazy things to people. And so if you can just, by all means, kind of go through those scenarios and stay involved as much as you can to avoid some of that. But and I recently came across a woman who does like family mediation and helps represent the person who maybe it's the elderly person or whatever to have the conversations with her family. So those might be awkward conversations. And so if you feel like you need a third party, there are professionals out there that can kind of sit in with you and help you. Because I think it's that the idea of advocating for your money can get a little bit intimidating too.
You need it. You need a neutral party. We've got a couple of more that I'm going to bring to you. But actually, I'm going to do an unusual thing for Goldster because this is such a sort of personal, important thing. I'm going to ask our audience, if you want to talk directly to Kaylee, we usually do it through the chat, but raise a yellow hand, I think it is, and I'll bring you in to talk to her directly and answer any questions or comment her and tell her she's talking rubbish because this is Goldster and we can say that sort of thing. But I am completely on the page of what you're saying. Jean Joyce says, the important thing is to know where your money is coming from and going to. If you're on your own, make sure a trusted family member knows this too. My daughter has lasting power of attorney. Hopefully she'll never need to use it. That sounds like a good situation, doesn't it, Kaylee, to me?
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. She can be the next professional. Like, she's just saying exactly what it is. Like, it is very, you know, simple and straightforward. That's it. Just be mindful of where your money's going. Yeah. And you're so many steps ahead of everyone else. If you can just tackle those things and do what she's written in that note, you're steps ahead of everyone.
Okay, so we've got Jean Joyce there is going to be our money guru, Goldster's money guru, we'll say, for doing that. Amber says, what if you do not have children or anyone you would trust to have your best interests at heart to make power of attorney? What happens then? Good question.
It is a good question, yeah. So there's professionals that you can get in place for that, like actual like bank organizations or trust organizations where they step in and they do have to act as a neutral third party. So it's more of like an entity, you think. It's not necessarily a person, because there could be a specific person in the role, but that could change as they bring on new people and things like that, because the timing is, of course, unknown. So yeah, that's one option. And I would say that's good, because they do have to act in a certain, you know, capacity as a very neutral third party, and they have rules to adhere to. So I think that's a safe bet if you don't have a family member or someone you really trust, putting that in place. And generally, nothing has to be paid to those people. I don't know for sure, depending on the place you're working with, but usually the payment doesn't come into play until you're actually utilizing their services.
Oh, okay. So they'll draw it up. You have them in your will or your power of attorney thing, and then it kicks in. And it would kick in to such an extent that if you have got vulture-like relatives saying, no, this house is mine, or this car is mine, or this holiday is mine, that professional with the power of attorney can override all that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and make sure that that although you don't have capacity, you can have a comfortable place to live and all the rest. I want to move on. We've been so so waylaid by the questions that but keep them coming, because I'm finding them interesting. Some of the phrases that you have from the book. There's one here right at the beginning. You see the early money messages. What is an early money message?
Yeah, I love this one. So I think like the idea of our early money experiences have so much impact on where we're at now with our money. And again, growing up for me, the messages were quite negative about money. It was like this scarcity. We never have enough. You know, we can't save money. Money's hard. You have to work really hard for it. So that was my sort of inner story with money. And I literally, like out of university or in high school, I had two jobs over the summer. And then in university, I held two jobs. And I finished university. I was working like a big girl job. And I was still working two jobs. I was working at like Shoppers Drug Mart in the evenings, like a pharmacy. And I'm just like, what am I doing? Like, it's very weird when I stop to assess, like, I don't have to do this anymore. I don't have to be working, you know, 14-hour days and things like that. So that was some of the money messages. And then that's how they were playing out. But I point out in the book, too, it can be good and bad messages. So the good ones being, I had an example of a woman who was taught, you know, you save money. You diligently save. So she was doing that all along the way. She had done a really good job, and she was actually able to retire early. Which was fabulous, and she wanted to. So, you know, we worked out the numbers and she did it. But then, you know, a couple, like almost like a year and some go past, and I'm like, you're not taking out any money. Like, that's sort of the goal, right? You saved it all up. Now you have to start kind of taking it out, drawing on it as your income now in retirement. And she's like, but I shouldn't be, like, I should be saving. And so she couldn't get her head around actually spending the money, because she was taught you save. You save all your money. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really hard lesson. And for her to go through that, we just had to start really small and sending her very small amounts until she got comfortable and, you know, and change that mindset and realize that that's what that money was there for. So the early money messages, whether good or bad, can have an impact. And so, and maybe like an unintended impact. So I ask people in the activity, at the end of each of the chapters, I have activities to do, and I keep them really simple. Again, I like to keep things easy. But one being to find out, you know, what those messages were and how they might be impacting you is write down some of the things you think and feel about money. Like if it is those things, like for myself, it was like you have to work really hard for money, or like hers, you always have to save money. Write down whatever it is. And then when you look at each of them, decide, is this actually true? And what you'll find is the majority aren't. Like I've had people on podcasts I've been on say things like, money is the root of all evil. And so I'm like, write that sentence down and then decide, you know, is that true? Of course it's not true. Like there's very nice people that have a lot of money, and you know, maybe there's some bad people or whatnot, but there's going to be a mix. So that's not true. So it's writing it all down, deciding, is it true? And then when you realize it's not, off for the most part, you get to now choose, like, what do I want to believe? What messages do I want to use going forward that are going to support me? So is it, you know, I'm learning, I'm increasing my financial literacy, I'm open to creative ways to saving money, I'm, you know, I'm abundant and I am like growing my wealth and I'm going to have a wonderful early retirement. Like whatever it is that you want to believe, write those down and have those start being the messages. So whatever you can do to change that messaging.
You just mentioned creative ways of saving your money, and you have a chapter 9. It is investing builds wealth, but it doesn't have to. It's a sort of thing. Give us some creative way. I mean, I can think there's the stock market, and there's a million things inside the stock market. There's deposit accounts, there's bonds. I never really understood what they are, but give us some of the safer creative ways to invest money.
Yeah, absolutely. So investing money, it doesn't have to be scary. Like the stock markets and investing, it can be very intimidating as well, especially if it's a new concept, you're not used to it. And of course, there's usually like horror stories that come along with it of someone telling you like, oh, my cousin's friend invested it all and they lost all their money. And so, of course, you're like in extreme fear because that's what it sounds like. It's very scary, but it doesn't have to be. So the idea of investing, and it doesn't have to be scary. Kind of my best tips for that is making sure you're investing ongoing. That's a great like tool to implement. So if you can set it up with every paycheck where you're like, okay, on the 15th of the month, I put, you know, $200 in and it goes into this investment ongoing every month. So that way the markets are going up, the markets are going down, sideways, whatever. And you're kind of getting in all along the way. So it really helps reduce some of the volatility and take away some of that pressure of thinking, I have to buy in the markets when the stock markets hit the bottom and I have to sell when they get to the very top. That's really hard to do. And I would argue that no one really has the ability to do that with extreme precision. So just be mindful of saying, can I just invest ongoing? That's a really good tool to do.
Okay.
Be diversified. So don't have all your eggs in one basket. So don't just buy one stock, one company, because that is risky. What if that one company goes bankrupt? What if some bad news comes out? So having like a basket of holdings is a really great tool where you don't have to be as worried of having just one thing. And then understanding your time horizon. So there's kind of different like levels of what you need the money for. You might say, well, I need this money next year for a down payment on a house I want to buy. I need this money in 10 years for when my kids are going to post-secondary and I want to help pay for it. I need this money for my retirement in 25 plus years. So those are all going to have probably a different type of investment for that goal. Like you can do something like bonds and, you know, something secure for those very short term timeframes. And then when you say, well, my retirement is 20 years plus off, I can invest in the markets and not be as concerned because I can handle some up and down. I have a long time frame. So for me, it's like for my retirement account, I don't really even monitor it that closely because I know that I'm not retiring. I mean, I have a 1.5-year-old. I have probably some time ahead of me before retirement. So
this is very interesting. So you have separate pots. Mm-hmm. Instead of your one pension fund, which people think that they have, you're thinking these separate pots for these separate stages of your life. And you constantly put money into it into each pot over the years.
Yeah, I see it as having like different buckets with different goals because it's not going to be the same. How I invest money for my kids' education is safer because I have also a 9-year-old. So she's about, let's say, 10 years or so away from going to post-secondary. So how I invest that money versus my retirement in 20 years, maybe I would like it be earlier, but whatever, it's going to be different. So we have to acknowledge that if we're investing correctly, it's like dressing for the weather, right? If we, you know, if it's a cold day and we make sure we bring our scarf and mittens and things like that, we're going to be okay. But if you don't, you're probably going to freeze. So it's just being mindful of like when you're investing correctly for the goal, you should be fine. Like you can take some of that fear of what are the markets going to do? And what if this economy crashes? And what if we get a recession? That shouldn't concern you if you're investing properly for each goal.
But because it will always pick up, will it? In you know, I've lived through a number of crashes and friends say, look, I'm selling everything. I'm getting out. I'm going to buy wine or something. You know, it's safe. Yeah. But actually it does, the structures, those sort of mainstream structures always pick up if you're looking years ahead.
It has, like historically it always has. So it's funny. Yeah. It's like there's a whole emotional roller coaster of like, oh my gosh, I'm getting out. And it's usually at the very bottom when everyone's running for the exit. It's the worst time possible to get out because then it goes rebounds and they miss out on that. So usually like there's a stat that shows that investment performance was best in accounts of dead people. as in like there was no one monitoring the account and it just kind of kept doing its thing. And they had the best results because they didn't do anything. So invest like a dead person.
I'm gonna ask you in a second about money mistakes, which you've got there, but Suri has got a quite an interesting question here. Is it wise to disclose passwords of online accounts to children while one can still manage money himself? Trusting children is fine, but they are influenced by their spouse. Yes.
Yeah.
Kaylee?
Oh, that's a tough one. Like, I hope my kids don't date people I don't approve of one day. I wouldn't give it away. Like, I think everyone would advise it's not good to give any passwords away. Usually there's a way if they have like a ability to kind of have a view of your account that they can have their own login. I would say kind of utilize that instead first off. But if there is someone that you think would have their hands on it too and you don't really trust, then by all means, just you don't have to give that away right now, right? You can, again, label them as this person in case of emergency. They would be able to, you know, speak on behalf of you or make decisions and things like that. And so only have it come into play for those scenarios. Like, I would say when it comes to passwords, everyone's advice is don't give those away to anyone. So get them. Yeah.
If you keep it simple, then you can actually keep managing it for much longer than if it's complicated.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't necessarily need the help.
Yeah. And you have a chapter called Turning Money Mistakes into Money Wisdom. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. I think money mistakes, they're the worst things possible because they're the things that oftentimes, if you have again, it goes back to that trauma of like an experience. So if you did something and you're like, oh, that was such a stupid decision, then you start saying like, I'm terrible with money and da da da. And those things are not serving you. That's not helping you make money your thing, right? That's not helping you build wealth. So money mistakes, we have to let go of them. We have to decide that it's a learning experience. So turn money mistakes into money lessons, I say. So treat it as a lesson. What did you learn from it? And I list some of mine. I'm like, oh, I met some guy in Vegas and, you know, I thought we were meant to be together. I traveled to London to go see him. And yeah, he turned out to be not a nice guy. And I'm like, that was a waste of money because I put on my credit card. I was like in my early 20s, like stupid things like that where I look back on too. I've made money mistakes for sure. So we've all made them and some are huge and some aren't as big and that's fine. But if we stay in it and dwell in it, it's going to almost like paralyze us, the fear. And like we were talking about before the show, it was like the biggest thing is taking action. Like you just have to take action with your money and do these steps and things and the very simple things, but you have to be taking action. So if you're paralyzed with fear over a mistake you made, you're not going to be taking action. So can we change how we're looking at those? So money mistake, treat it as a money lesson. And an activity for that chapter I think I give is just write down the mistake. Write down the lesson. What did you learn from it? Because then at least you're using it for something, right? You're saying, well, this is what I learned from it. I'm not going to just, you know, quickly book a trip to London before I get to know the guy better or something like that. And then what you're grateful for, because gratitude is a great way to come out of negativity. So if you can throw in at the end something you're grateful for, it helps build up that, like boost that mindset and feel a bit better. So dwell on money mistakes.
The money mistake or paralysis that you mentioned just now, that would be, say, leaving all your capital or whatever you got in a low interest deposit account for years when you could actually be, as you said, you know, at 8% or 5% or something could be getting that. Yes,
yeah, getting your money to work. Yeah, exactly. I've come across so many women that have the savings part down, like they're socking it away, but it might as well be hiding under their mattress because it's like literally having $1 million just sitting in the bank. I'm like, you got to get that money working for you. Like that's the next step. That's what, if you want to know what do wealthy people do, they get their money working for them. Yeah. And again, it doesn't have to be high risk. It doesn't have to be scary, but there's even simple ways. We're in an environment right now where interest rates have gone up. So you're getting a good return on your cash just instead of having it sit there and get nothing. And if they're not calling you up and being proactive, they're not going to because it benefits them to not have to pay you, higher interest.
And just to sort of, you've got these bank accounts where you can put it in on fixed deposit that gives X amount. And then you've got the stock market that pays dividends and possibly it could go up and it goes down. You know, the dividend, the blue chip companies. And then you've got bonds, which is the companies borrowing your money and then giving you a higher interest. Is any one of those preferable or is it Are you pretty much safe in all of those? Or
I would say it just goes back to, again, that like buckets and time frames. So stock market, longer term goals, great. Like medium to longer term. So yes, my kid's education fund has some stock investments because we still have a bit of time left on there. My retirement, yes. But if I have like, oh, I'm saving this money for, you know, a big trip we're doing next year. No, I don't want to throw that in the stock markets because it could go down like 30% next year or something like that. So, but again, long term, it's done really well and done. But so that's going to be maybe some sort of term deposit, something no risk, low risk, just getting more of a return on my cash. So it's just being smart about like time frames. If you need the money soon, don't put it in something like equity investment. Something like a bond or like a term deposit or something would be a better bet for that.
Because a bond is safer as long as the company doesn't go bankrupt.
Then there's of course the whole tricky interest rate thing though. Last year bonds went down a lot because interest rates went up. So bonds are inversely related to interest rates. If interest rates go up, bond prices go down. So they can be tricky. But so again, that's more like moderate. That's saying like, okay, don't put your down payment for a house you're saving in something like that because you need a very specific amount. You don't want to risk it. So something like that, keeping that really safe, no risk bucket.
Yeah, that's it. Amber says here, if I can, ISAs. Do you have those in Canada? We have ISAs where you can put your money into it up to a certain amount, and anything that happens in your ISA is tax-free.
Okay. We have a TFSA. That's what ours equivalent is. That's a great tool to use.
Yeah, and that means, and you can run that yourself, can't you? Our ISAs, I think you can run yourself or you can have your fund manager do it, but you can buy and sell in there without paying any tax.
Yes.
And then take stuff out without paying any tax.
Yes. Yeah. That's a fabulous tool as like a supplement. You don't have to think of it even as short term. You could say that's more of like a supplement to your retirement. So you could say, I'm going to invest in there. I'm going to buy stocks. I'm going to get dividends, things like that. I don't have to pay tax on them because it's all inside there. And then when I take it out later on, maybe I'm getting some sort of pension, which is taxable, but maybe I'm pulling out of there to supplement that income because that's not taxable. So it's a great tool to use in even a retirement scenario.
Yeah. I'm just looking down. This is shot through this thing. It's okay to like money. You may even grow to love it. And then you say it's more than just money. These are two chapter things you've got. Sum up those thoughts for us.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that we can love money. I think like I'm coming from a woman's perspective, but I think especially as women, we oftentimes don't feel comfortable thinking it's okay to even like money, to have these conversations, to talk about money, to invest money. But of course we can like money. And I would hope that you grow to love it. And because money is nothing in itself, like it's not necessarily the money you're loving. Like you don't want to like get into a pile of money and, you know, throw it around. And like, that's not the joy.
Like a waterbed.
Yes, like just flowing money. That gets boring probably after a few minutes. But what it is what it like, it's a tool for the goals that we want to do. Like I told you before the call, I'm going to Disneyland next week with my daughter and money. Like I love Disneyland. And how is that made possible? By money. So of course I can love money because I get to go to the place I love, Disneyland, because of it, because of the money I've earned and saved and whatnot. So we have to acknowledge that it's okay to like money and even love it. It doesn't mean we're greedy. It doesn't mean that, oh, like you're so focused on money or like it's almost like it becomes like a bad quality or trait and of like, no, of course not. And so we have to get rid of that because if you don't like money or if you act like, no, I don't care about it or it's not important. Well, guess what? You're not going to get any money or you're not going to be abundant. You're not going to get Disneyland. So if you want Disneyland, you better love money. Yeah. And then the idea of, we have to kind of dig deeper into money and understand our values. Because a lot of the money guilt, when we feel guilty about spending money, usually the reason is like we're spending it on something that doesn't align with our values. So I love adventure and I've always wanted to make my goal was to take my children traveling and going places because I didn't get to do that growing up. So that was always something important to me. So when I spend money on a Disney vacation, I don't feel guilty about it. I feel really happy and joy and excited. But if I spend money on like, I don't know, like a designer purse or something, for me personally, I'm like, well, I probably shouldn't have got that. I didn't need that. And maybe for you, though, it does bring joy and happy, and it's something you've always wanted.
What is this idea of retail therapy? Is that, is that a false...
I don't think it's a false
feel-good feeling.
It is, yeah. So you have to dig into what is that therapy. Like, we have to acknowledge that it goes so much deeper. Like, the spending is just the result of something else. Like, and I don't think the whole, like, the counseling and psychology stuff digs deep enough into the money ideas of, like, yeah, retail therapy and almost, like, the addiction and things like that. Like, I think a lot of people spend money because of the feel good that they get really quick. So on a bad day, I'll just, you know, go to the mall or something, or
show
on a good
off.
Day.
So what investments to choose depends on one's age. Yes, given what you just said, not risky investments in old age is wise. What should you go for if it's sort of the last cycle or a late cycle of life?
Yeah, like, you just want to keep scaling back on the risk. So when you're young, again, maybe it's like you're fully invested in the stock markets when you're young and you have the long time frame. And then as you get closer and you start aging, you start scaling that back and saying, okay, now maybe I'm 80% in high, you know, stock markets, thing like that, but 20% in bonds and lower risk. And then, as I'm getting closer to retirement, now I'm 40% in those kind of safer and 60%. Yeah. So I think it's just that balance and kind of continually to decrease. But if you're at a place in a retirement too where you sort of have what you need and you don't necessarily need a lot more, if you've done kind of the financial planning exercise and you have enough, then maybe it is just being very low risk, no risk, and just earning some interest, because you don't need to make a certain amount of money. So I think it's just being mindful of your specific goals and where you're at and what you sort of need to achieve for return. Because you don't probably, at a certain point, if you see your money and what you use and things like that, there might be a point you get to, which, you know, ideally everyone gets to, where it's like, I don't need to get huge investment returns. I just need my money at least to do something.
Can I ask you to wait there for one minute whilst I tell our wonderful audience what's coming up next? And let us know in the audience, and I'm going to ask you, Kelly, whether you are at peace with your financial future, which is one of the questions you ask in the book. But tomorrow I am with Michael Muthukrishna and his much talked about book called A Theory of Everyone, that looks about how we solve the big challenges of our future. Will we need money? I'll ask you that when I finish this. Tuesday, January the 9th on Purpose, Passion and Grit, Lucinda is with Poppy Lloyd, a veteran of working with street children in Africa. And she's the marketing director of First News. That's Britain's only newspaper for children. January the 11th, Lucinda is in Riverstone, Kensington, live and a Zoom event with the wonderful novelist Amanda Craig and her new book, The Three Graces. January 12th, Rachel Trethewey returns to Goals to Inside Story with her new book, Mothers of the Mind. These are the mothers of Virginia Woolf, Agatha Christie and Sylvia Plath. What impact do mothers have on us? January the 16th, Purpose, Passion, Grit. I'm with Jeff Cox. His book is Somerset in the News, but we're going to discuss community. What makes a community? We're going to want to know it from you, our audience, just as we wanted to know about money. That first book about the theory of everything, what's going to happen to money in the future? We barely use cash anymore, Kaylee.
That's a hard question. And what I don't know, unfortunately, I don't have the psychic abilities, but I think it's going to, we're going to be more of a cashless society, which I think is quite dangerous and even more of a need that we need to be tracking. Because when we had the paper dollar bills, when I had that $20 limit on my bank account, when the money runs out, it runs out. But when we have credit cards and things like that, it's just, we tap away and, you know, we go into these big piles of debt, which I think it's happening more so now that we've moved away from using actual currency. So I think the risk that lies ahead is that, we can get even more kind of out of control with spending.
Apps and online confusion that we heard about earlier on. I'm going to wrap up. I'm going to ask you a goals to question that I ask everybody. Yours is going to be about money. Supposing you suddenly find yourself with a pile of stuff about money. Maybe your spouse or something has left you in debt or something. You don't understand it. You hit this paralysis you talk about. Give us the top sentence of how people should get through that.
get the book, make money or things.
Apart from promoting your own book.
Okay, take inventory. So like take a moment and then just establish kind of where you're at. So take that inventory, understand where you stand right now, what we kind of call like a net worth statement. And we didn't really go much into that, but understanding assets, liabilities. So just really getting the awareness. I think step one is awareness. Also the mindset piece we talked about. So working on that positive mindset, because that's going to help you feel open to taking on this next step.
That is brilliant. Thank you for that. We've got some messages coming in. A very important message here today says, Ewan Grant, that was so helpful. Jennifer, thank you. I missed the beginning. Look forward to it on catch up. I've just put in the link that if anybody wants to press that, they can find the book. Jean Joyce, very interesting guest. Look forward to catching up on Geeta, who's one of our regulars. Really interesting interview. That is it. Time's winged chariot is upon us, and we have to stop, and that has gone quickly. Until tomorrow, when we learn about a theory of everyone and the future of money, I'll ask him about that. Stay warm, be generous, know how your money works, be social, and no better way than that than with goals to tell your friends and family about us, even your enemies. Make sure they don't come after your money, though. Definitely go to your financial advisors. We have a wonderful one as our guest today. And thank you all for your questions and comments. And thank you, Kelly Boisvert, for being so open, clear, and knowledgeable in helping us get through that labyrinth of finances. Make money our thing, your thing. Come back when you've made your next billion. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody. Bye, Katie. Hope to see you soon.
Bye. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for your questions.
Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.goldster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goldster.